All right. So can you first just tell me about yourself and your organization?
Sure. My name is Glenn Caroline. I'm the director of the NRA's Grassroots Division. My main job at NRA is to recruit, train, and mobilize our members to support our legislative and election related activities. I've been working at NRA now for a little over 25 years. I came here right from college after I graduated at UMass, we were just talking about. And the NRA was founded in 1871 following the Civil War by a group of Union Army officers who were very impressed with the marksmanship skills of the defeated Southern soldiers, and they wanted to make sure there would be a national entity set up to promote firearm safety training and marksmanship. So the NRA was incorporated in the state of New York in 1871, and we've been in existence ever since, and we are the largest and oldest sportsmen's and civil rights organization in the country.
So have you been involved in any legislation related to gun control or anything like that?
Sure. I mean, any federal legislative fight since I started here in 1991, I've been involved in some degree, either by making sure our members were engaged, articulating the NRA's position to their elected members of Congress, and or it was a brief time, part of my job was to be a federal lobbyist for the NRA, but I actually go to Capitol Hill and speak to members of Congress and their staff about our legislative agenda.
So this is going to seem obvious because of where we are, but what is your position on gun control, and can you just talk about a little bit about why and how that kind of plays out in your everyday life?
As it's generally defined, gun control is something we would oppose because we understand that criminals by definition are lawbreakers and they don't abide by laws regulating gun ownership, and that conversely the only people who are affected by these laws are law-abiding gun owners. We don't think there's any merit, if you're truly concerned in reducing crime, to passing laws that will be ignored by criminals, but will disenfranchise and limit the choices of law-abiding citizens. Further, it's important to understand that if you were to add up all the laws we currently have on the books regulating gun ownership, laws passed by Congress that affect all 320 million Americans, laws passed by each state legislature regulating gun ownership and possession within their states, and even down to the city and town and local level, we already have thousands of existing laws already on the books. What we feel is a better solution is, rather than enacting new laws, is having a renewed commitment to enforcing existing laws against actual criminals.
So what do you think about the propositions that are on the table about banning guns for people on the terrorist watch list, for example, or the mentally ill? And I know that those are two separate issues, but if you could just talk a little bit.
Well, let's take them in turn. Our problem with this so-called terrorist watch list is this is a secret government list that nobody knows how or why they've been put on the list, and there's no due process to protest or get yourself off of the list. We don't believe you should lose a constitutional right if you aren't gone through the if you haven't gone through the due process notification. There's been a lot of errors and questions on how people got on this secret list, and some people don't find out they're prohibited from exercising a constitutional right until they take that step to do so. So you're not going to find any argument from NRA that known terrorists should not be able to own guns and are legally not entitled to own guns. But we do have grave constitutional concerns about stripping a constitutional right of an American citizen with no due process. That's a constitutional problem. As far as the mentally ill, since 1968, it has been against federal law for anybody who's been adjudicated as mentally incompetent from owning a gun. Basically what that means, if there's been some type of finding that someone's mental health is a danger to themselves or others, and there's been a due process hearing, that person can be prohibited from owning a gun, as is somebody who has been involuntarily committed to a mental health facility. For decades, we have said that if your mental health history disqualifies you from owning guns, that information should be in what's called the National Instant Criminal Background Check System, which is the computer screening process that one goes through anytime he or she tries to purchase a gun from a federally licensed dealer. So we believe that those whose mental health histories disqualify them from owning guns should not be able to own guns and should be in the NICS system, as long as it's gone through the due process that we just discussed. The challenge we have is many, many states have been delinquent in actually turning over some of their mental health records that are relevant into the National Instant Criminal Background Check System. So we believe that the records of anybody who's disqualified under law from getting a gun ought to be in that system.
So how do you interpret the Second Amendment, and in particular that first clause that's always kind of out there that is discussed?
Sure. Well, how I interpret it is really irrelevant. What we need to look at is what did those individuals who wrote the Second Amendment intend when they wrote it, mm-hmm. and what have legal scholars and courts found who've looked at and interpreted it. Mm-hmm. So if you just kind of back up and you think about the original reason, the very original reason that the Second Amendment was included in the Constitution was to make sure American citizens would have the means, the tools and firearms to protect our liberty from our own government if they ever became tyrannical. If you remember the founding of our nation, we had freed ourselves from the British monarchy, and the founding fathers were very concerned about concentrating too much power in the hands of a small, strong national government. So that was the original reason it was included. I think the practical day application of the Second Amendment is it affords law-abiding Americans the choice to own the firearm of their choice for any legitimate, lawful purpose. Now, in the hundreds of years since that document has been written, the Bill of Rights and the Second Amendment in particular, there have been hundreds of law review articles that have examined the Founding Fathers' intent that have concluded they intended to guarantee an individual right to keep and bear arms. There have been many, many court cases, including two Supreme Court cases in the last 8 or 9 years that have specifically mentioned and affirmed the individual right to keep and bear arms. Mm-hmm. If you think about where the Second Amendment is included in our Constitution, it's in the first 10 amendments to our Constitution, the Bill of Rights, which are basically essential freedoms that we as Americans enjoy that were so important that the Bill of Rights was included to prevent government intrusion or government usurping those freedoms. So I think all Americans would agree we have an individual right to freely practice our own religion, an individual right to free speech, and an individual right to be secure from unwarranted searches and seizures. Those freedoms, those protections are laid out in the very same part of the Constitution, the Bill of Rights, as is the Second Amendment. So even though we've seen law review articles and scholars and courts and Congress has enacted legislation on at least 4 occasions that cite the individual nature of the Second Amendment, if you just kind of use common sense, do you really think that the Founding Fathers would mean for 9 of the 10 amendments in the Bill of Rights to protect an individual right except for the Second Amendment? So I think today we can have a debate or discussion as to whether or not people still want the Second Amendment to guarantee an individual right, mm-hmm. but I don't think there can be any debate as to what the Founding Fathers intended when they wrote the Second Amendment.
Great. So given the Second Amendment, what restrictions do you think going forward can be put on guns? And obviously there are already a lot of restrictions that have been put on guns, but in talk about banning guns and things like that, what do you think is even possible given that we have that written in our Constitution?
Right. Well, let me just change the terminology. Let's not talk about the tool. Let's not talk about this inanimate object, the gun. Mm-hmm. Let's talk about restrictions placed on the human being who seeks to own that gun. Because really what we believe in is we believe in regulating the behavior. Mm-hmm. That is, for us, the tool, the gun itself, is irrelevant. What determines whether or not somebody ought to be able to own a particular type of firearm is what are their qualifications at the time that they seek to own that gun. So there are, you know, dozens of disqualifying conditions under federal law that preclude somebody today from owning a gun. Convicted felons, certain misdemeanors, misdemeanor crimes of domestic violence, adjudicated as mentally incompetent, fugitive from justice, dishonorably discharged from the armed services. So there are a number of disqualifying factors already in place. So I think when we have this discussion, it's better to really talk about making sure, how can we better ensure that people who are legally disqualified from owning guns don't get access to them? And what you have to understand is most criminals, again, by definition, are lawbreakers, and they don't obey laws. So if you look at the main ways that criminals get guns, it's through the black market. It's through straw purchases where that somebody with a clean record goes in and buys a gun and then illegally transfer it to somebody who's prohibited. So I think the best way to reduce gun violence, which is something that all Americans want, is to use the existing laws we have at our disposal and have a commitment to enforcing those laws when somebody breaks the law.
Okay. So America has a very high murder and mass shooting rate as opposed to countries where guns are banned. Let's take Japan, for example. How do you respond to that, and how do you think that that plays out in our current day, given that that's kind of a fact?
Well, first of all, some of the worst mass shootings in the world have happened in countries outside of the United States, mm-hmm. whether it's Norway or Germany. You cite Japan as an example. Japan, despite its very, very strict gun laws, has a suicide rate that's much higher than that of the United States. So I think it's kind of an apples and oranges comparison to simply say, because of country A's gun laws or gun ownership and its crime rate, and comparing that to country B's gun ownership rate or gun laws and crime rate, to just draw a conclusion. Mm-hmm. There are a lot of differences between societies. There are a lot of differences between countries and government and the criminal justice system. So I don't really think that's a good analogy. Mm-hmm. What I would direct your attention to is, let's look within our own borders. Let's look at a city like Chicago that has arguably the most strict gun control laws of any city, any jurisdiction in the country, yet is arguably the most violent, most dangerous city in the country, despite its strict gun laws. So again, I think what you have to look at is more commonality as opposed to foreign countries' gun laws and their corresponding crime rates, because there are also other countries that have very high gun ownership rates that also have very low crime rates. Mm-hmm. So there are so many different factors involved with comparing the United States to different countries that I think it's way too broad to draw a causation or a correlation between gun laws and gun deaths.
Absolutely. So what do you believe should be the limit on where and when people can carry guns?
We believe if you're a qualified law-abiding citizen, you should have the right to carry a firearm and to defend yourself any place you have a legal right to be. Now, there are certain sterile areas that provide, you know, like an airport where you go through a metal detector screening, where perhaps those are places where are secure enough that maybe that could be something that we could discuss. But generally speaking, we believe if you're a law-abiding citizen, you should have a right to defend yourself, including armed defense, if that's what you choose as the tool to defend yourself, anywhere you have a legal right to be.
Okay. Do you think that the government should or could have the right to ban certain guns, such as guns with high-capacity magazines, or that term that gets thrown around a lot, like semi-automatic or automatic rifles or things like that?
Well, the government really doesn't have rights. The government has powers. And the way our system works is, if Congress passes a law and the president signs it into law, that is the law of the land. We had a decades-long experiment from 1994 to 2004 with a ban on certain types of semi-automatics and so-called high-capacity magazines. What we saw is it didn't have any appreciable effect on the crime rate. It didn't have any appreciable effect on whether or not those types of guns were used in the commission of crimes, because, very frankly, before, during, and after the ban expired, the types of guns you're talking about aren't disproportionately used to commit crimes to begin with. So the way our system works is, the people elect a Congress to make laws, and the president executes those laws. There are laws in place that we disagree with, that we will work through the legislative process to overturn. There are laws that we think need to be put in place to strengthen the rights of law-abiding citizens that we will work through the process to try to get passed through Congress and signed by the president. But, you know, if Congress passes a law and the president signs it, even if it's a law over the NRA's objection that we disagree with, it still is the law. Mm-hmm. Then we have to decide, is there any remedial action either through the courts to overturn it as unconstitutional, or through the legislative process to pass a law to strike it from the books or pass something new? And we work within the process to try to effect that type of legislative and statutory change when necessary.
Mm-hmm. Okay. But so, just talking about different types of guns, you think that they're isn't necessarily a difference between what occurs when certain types of guns are banned and what occurs now?
We don't believe in gun bans, period.
Right.
As I said at the outset, there are no such things as good guns or bad guns. What dictates whether a gun is used for beneficial purposes or nefarious purposes is the human user of that firearm. So whether a gun's a semi-automatic, a bolt action, a pump action, a single shot, a revolver, that's really not the driving issue for us, because we protect the rights of law-abiding citizens to own all those types of guns. Mm-hmm. But who we're advocating for are the law-abiding citizens to exercise their constitutional choice. Obviously, the people that we discussed earlier that are prohibited under law shouldn't have the right to own any gun. And we don't want them to own any gun. And if they violate a law trying to buy a gun, we want there to be a swift, certain punishment to make sure they're not in a position to do so again. But we don't discriminate based on the type or the action or the way a gun looks or functions, because it's just an inanimate object. It's a tool. We look at the qualifications of the citizen who's trying to purchase that gun.
Okay. And then, in light of events like Sandy Hook or Columbine and mass shootings like that, what do you think is the correct response? Because, I mean, a lot of people want there to be a response in terms of legislation that gets passed banning guns or regulating guns more heavily. What do you think is the
correct
response?
I think after tragedies like that happen, the emotions surrounding the issue change and they get heightened, but really the facts surrounding the gun control debate doesn't change. And I think when we're talking about legislating, when we're talking about enacting laws that are going to affect millions of Americans, we have to legislate based from a point of knowledge and doing something that we think will actually address the problem, mm-hmm. rather than something that makes us feel good as if we did something, mm-hmm. but doesn't address the problem and sometimes makes things worse. So specific to examples like that, I think the first thing we have to do is take a step back and collect the facts of what happened. How did the person get a gun? Was the person qualified or not? What existing laws were broken? Are there any other laws that could have prevented that from happening in the first place? And I think if we take kind of a step back and look at the facts, that's a better way to navigate any type of legislative response than simply reacting in the heat of emotion and trying to dust off previous legislative proposals that have failed and using a shooting such as a political opportunity to advance an agenda. Mm-hmm. You talked about Newtown. If you remember the facts of Newtown, the shooter's mother legally owned that gun under very strict Connecticut laws. The actual shooter shot and killed his mother, stole the gun, broke the law of bringing the gun onto a school zone, which was illegal, and then proceeded to kill many, many people, which was already illegal. Mm-hmm. It's hard to make what that individual did any more illegal than it already is. Mm-hmm. But there were groups out there that used that tragedy to try to advance a legislative agenda and push for things that really had no direct bearing on that Newtown shooting, but were previous legislative proposals that they think this is a target of opportunity for us to now push a legislative agenda. We don't think that you should legislate and try to capitalize on tragedy using emotion. We think you should use fact, logic, and reason and really look at the facts of a situation and what legislative proposals may or may not have been able to make a difference.
And lastly, why do you think it's so difficult to compromise on this issue? And, I mean, there's been debate over this for decades. And so why do you think that it's so hard to find the middle ground on the issue of gun control?
Yeah, well, I mean, compromise is a difficult thing to define. But I think when you're talking about restricting on a constitutionally guaranteed right, what Americans are willing to tolerate is much higher than what they would on, say, some type of government-granted privilege. Just like any issues surrounding the First Amendment make it more challenging, there are certain fundamental freedoms that we as Americans enjoy, one of them being our Second Amendment rights, that make quote-unquote compromising challenging, because you're talking about whittling away a very fundamental component of our Constitution, the underpinning of our Bill of Rights and the Second Amendment. What we think is there are areas of agreement. That I think we agree there are certain classes of individuals that are currently prohibited by law that all Americans would agree shouldn't have guns. Mm-hmm. Now we have to ask ourselves, what is the best way to prevent those individuals from getting guns? One is to enforce the existing laws we already have in the books. And second is to make sure, unlike the city of Chicago that has a very poor prosecution record, that when we do find somebody who's broken a law, they have to go through the judicial process and there has to be a consequence for their activities. If you don't enforce the existing laws that are already on the books, not only are you making it easier for criminals to remain free and commit more crimes, not only are you breeding disrespect for all of our laws that are currently on the books, but you have to ask yourself, if we're unwilling to enforce the thousands of laws we already have on the books, why would we enact another one on top of that if we're not even enforcing the ones we currently have?
Got it. Okay, that's it. If there's anything else that you want to say or that you'd want me to include?
I would like you to understand the fact that even though we're talking about gun control legislation, the lobbying component, that's really just a small part of what the NRA does. Mm-hmm. A lot of what we do in this building really centers on one of our core missions of providing firearm safety and education. We have 125,000 certified instructors that train more than 1 million Americans, including law enforcement, every year. We have an award-winning gun safety program targeted to preschoolers through third grade called our Eddie Eagle Gun Safe Program that teaches children if they come across a firearm, they should stop, don't touch, run away, and tell a grown-up. So I think the point to make is NRA is offering a lot of solutions to the twin but separate challenge of reducing gun crime and gun accidents. We believe in fully enforcing existing laws. We believe that armed citizens have been proven to be good for self-defense of the community. We see that armed citizens use their firearms 1.5 million times a year for self-defense, which is about 3 to 4 times more often than a criminal will use a gun to commit a crime. And I'm just going to, you won't be able to see it, but just to kind of put a finer point in that, because I do think it's an important point. If you look at gun deaths in this country, Let me just use this as an example. Let's say a pushpin equals 1,000 gun deaths.
Okay.
Gun accidents, I can't cut this in half to show you, but it would be about half, maybe three quarters of this, less than 1,000 gun accidents every year, all right? So just think of it that way. Homicides are about 11,000. So think 11 pushpins, just to kind of put what I'm saying in perspective. The leading cause of gun death, truthfully, are suicides, which is something that a lot of people don't talk about as often, but there's 21,000 suicides, so 21 pushpins. When you talk about defensive uses of guns, they're used 1.5 million times a year. So that's 1,500 pushpins.
Okay.
So what I want to convey to you is that guns are more often used for defensive purposes by law-abiding citizens than they're used by criminals to commit a crime.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's something that the media often ignores or underreports.
Mm-hmm.
So I think if we're serious about reducing gun violence in this country and gun accidents, it has to be a component of enforcing existing laws against criminals. It has to be understanding that law-abiding citizens should have a right to defend themselves where they have a legal right to be. It's about making sure that people whose mental health histories prohibit them from owning a gun don't get access to guns or put in the National Instant Criminal Check System.
Mm-hmm.
But the flip side also is education, training, and the things that the NRA does to reduce gun accidents.
Mm-hmm.
So as you speak to people on the other side, I would be interested to find out what other than more gun control laws on top of the thousands that we already have they been pushing for? Are they advocating for? Are they spending their money on?
Mm-hmm.
And I've been asking questions like that of my opponents for many, many years now, and it's very hard to get an answer.
Mm-hmm.
And I think their silence truly speaks volumes.
Okay, great.